Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Carium, the telehealth platform enabling healthcare's digital transformation, helping you care for people within the fabric of their daily lives. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Jason Burham, General Manager, Healthcare Provider Segment, Clinical Effectiveness at Wolters Kluwer. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's great. And before we get into the main part of our conversation, what I always like to do is give my guests a chance to provide a little bit more of a background of who they are and what they do. So, Jason, the floor is yours.
Yeah, awesome. So I get the privilege of leading our business focused on bringing really the world's best clinical decision support and patient solutions to clinicians, providers, health systems all across North America, and really focused on connecting with health system leaders, discussing digital health, virtual care strategies, and just finding ways to support the best care possible, especially in this new environment across any care setting.
So, and what first brought you into healthcare?
Yeah, my origin story. It's good. What really started me on this journey was actually sitting next to a physician innovator on a plane en route to Dallas, Texas. This is the late 90s. I was in chip design in the manufacturing industry, but I was already, in love with the web and this whole opportunity that we had to kind of reinvent so many different things, including, this opportunity to really liberate data, improve insights, and create connections that you can never make before. And so I was in this mind space, and this physician who I was sitting next to is an industry colleague and good friend and still out there innovating in the industry. He was on a similar mission, yet he was really focused specifically on this creation of personal health records in the cloud before it was called the cloud, and making sure that healthcare consumers could own their data in the cloud. So this was all revolutionary at the time. And that effort, that we ended up collaborating around eventually evolved into a set of solutions that was acquired by WebMD. And a lot of those solutions live on today. But through that initial connection, I got really, really passionate and motivated about moving into an industry where I feel like every day is an impact opportunity. And it really got me going down this path of how do we find better ways always to close that knowledge gap between consumers and clinicians and just support better interactions between health consumers and clinicians and just, on the hunt for the best possible outcomes. And a lot, of course, always inspired by personal health experiences and family health experiences along the way as well. So.
So kind of the knowledge gap that you just mentioned, can we dive into that a little bit and can you kind of frame out what you mean by that?
Yeah, this is an interesting expert industry, right? And you find these paradigms where you have professionals around the world who engage with consumers in their industry. And whether it's, tax and accounting or law or healthcare, you have specialized experts that are directly connecting with consumers that need help. And oftentimes that help doesn't occur to the consumer until the need is most poignant. So they're already in this frazzled state of, and they're anxious, it's high impact because it's an important area of their life. Otherwise you wouldn't have a whole professional industry around it. Like, it's just such an interesting environment for an interaction to happen. And so this is that type of interaction between doctors and consumers, clinicians and consumers. And of course, clinicians have such a high level of training, and also they're seeing consumer after consumer after consumer. So they have the pattern recognition that we do so well as humans is like on overload with clinicians, just kind of like seeing all of the different patients they see, but patients don't get the benefit of any of that. It's all new material. So, one of the key, in my mind, it's always been about one of the key pillars is how do you close the knowledge gap and how do you do that in a way that consumers understand, because with a professional industry comes special language and special terms and So it's just at the heart of a lot of what drives me is how do we create environments to close those gaps and just get, you know, consumers and clinicians, specialists, professionals to have a really good productive dialogue that's very human.
And so how are you seeing kind of that drive to make it easier to understand or the closing of the gap? Like, how has that been evolving? Because, you know, I feel like, as you're saying, with especially with healthcare, it can be so specialized, and there are many terms of art that really only apply within that field. And then at the same time, you have, you know, these, I'll call them aspirational goals in many regulations that say, well, reduce the information down to, say, like a third or a fifth grade reading level. You know, so how do you actually go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of thought, a lot of expertise, and a lot of diligence to translate something like an algorithm that runs across a set of text and outputs a score of sixth grade reading level. And then, you know, in order to kind of go, yep, we're complying with, you know, well-intended policy that is trying to address that problem of literacy and fundamentally is picking up the same problem of kind of closing the knowledge gap and helping consumers be in a good position to educate themselves. I think, you know, when you start peeling it back, though, you start to realize look, you have to use very deliberate strategies because just getting to a score from an algorithm or a test does not guarantee understanding, and then changing that consumer's kind of appreciation for that into actually knowledge, and then knowledge into something that they can actually take action on that's real. Like it's not too aspirational. It's something they can actually do. So that whole process, I mean, in my experience, you have to combine the best of writing, the best of medical accuracy and consistency that's consistent with the evidence base, but then you have to layer on top, you know, behavior change science. You have to be able to address consumers in plain language with a hopeful tone, with action orientation, with a white space around text that is, you know, displayed in a bulleted format that allows for easy action and is expressed in a way that allows the consumer to visualize what change they want to make. And same with if you translate that into multimedia, which of course is an awesome medium for engaging and educating for the vast majority of learning styles. And same thing, you have to have an aesthetic that is that supports diversity, equity, and inclusion. I mean, you have to be able to present information in a way that doesn't isolate certain segments of your audience right out of the gate, just through a visual style or through a phrase, a colloquialism, or a phrase that kind of shuts down a part of your audience. So it's pretty multifaceted, and it's not for the faint of heart. And so I always, I think what keeps me focused and passionate about the part of the world where I live in the healthcare industry is I see a lot of our clients who I work with day in and day out, who oftentimes organizations well-intended will take a shot at doing some of this kind of work on their own. Like, hey, let's just create our own content. Let's just, you know, we know what we need to say. And we've got the best, we have the world leaders in this area of medicine. And they do. And they have insights that are unrivaled. But there's also that ability to communicate in a really effective, measurably effective way to an audience that's very different than the people oftentimes creating the content. So that's an interesting extra value that we get a chance to bring to the equation.
And no, I really like that insight, where, as you said, you can have definitely people who are foremost experts and clearly understand what they're talking about and know it, you know, probably more in depth than most other people ever will. But at the same time, when you know something so well, that's where it almost becomes even more challenging to be able to break it down and describe it in a way that other people who aren't working with it so frequently or haven't spent as so much time and energy and effort learning it, to be able to put it in a way where they can grasp it and then be able to work with it very easily. So the kind of getting that outside perspective to help, I think, as you were saying, with the translation of it is really valuable.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Tagging along with that and hearing some of your background, where, as you said, you started in the late 90s, and I know you mentioned selling something to WebMD, which might be a touch point of people thinking of one of the, or at least in my mind, it sticks out as one of the original sources where anyone could look up information and try to become educated themselves. So, getting your perspective on how that interaction of, trying to produce, as you said, kind of accurate and well-written materials along with stuff that is freely available and people trying to self-educate without always having the benefit of a filter of, is this well-grounded, well-proven, or is this someone just, to go to the extreme, just making it up? So, kind of how are those interactions influencing the knowledge gap and the ability to ensure that there's, I think, a strong and call mutually beneficial relationship among, clinicians and patients and consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, right on, WebMD is one of the pioneering brands that really took advantage of the proliferation of web tools and web knowledge to the benefit of health consumers. And I think, one of the things I always have appreciated about my experience with, in contributing to kind of the WebMD's, collection of solutions is that, without the benefit of that investment, and regardless of the way you think about whatever the commercialization strategy is for WebMD, because actually, if you go to the .com experience, you've got a lot of, ad supported experiences. And sometimes that can kind of, it depends on your perspective, and even the consumer's perspective, it can jade you a little bit, because you see medical manufacturer, you see pharmaceutical ads, and that really is what allows this kind of expert-based content to be revealed. In the absence of that, though, you have to be a little pragmatic. In the absence of that funding mechanism, you don't have the benefit of professionally created and curated, content and education opportunities. And so I think, certainly we've moved a long way forward since then as an industry. But I think even though in those early days, this idea that healthcare is special, and even if you see some of the work that Google has done to create kind of a knowledge graph, when you search for healthcare terms, you've got a call out a prioritization of kind of expert sourced information to support what Google is thinking is the needs of that healthcare term search that happened in their search engine. So I think we all recognize that health is special, and you need the benefit of expert sources. And the bibliography matters. And even if nobody ever reads the bibliography, the fact that the bibliography exists and there's comfort that when you scroll at the bottom, there are dates and timestamps and people's names with MD and other, special designations at the end, and that the content has been put through its paces. It's necessary. We have to be able to display that. And I think, the benefit that we have now is that with the digitization of care delivery, moving beyond the ACA, introduction of the ACA in 2010, but, kind of that digital transformation, we're at a stage now where the benefits of digitization is happening in the process of care delivery, and patients and clinicians are benefiting from that. And I think, the experience that we've had over the past 16 months or so, where the world turned upside down and we had to get really creative and think about new ways to engage consumers, only kind of accelerates the opportunity for us to move, you know, more in that direction.
You know, and I think I definitely want to dive into that. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Jason Burham from Wolters Kluwer. And Jason, you're just talking about, you know, the benefits of digitization and the acceleration that's occurred as a result of the COVID pandemic. So, you know, can you give any examples of, you know, the transitions or, you know, the new method or kind of new methods or new interactions that are coming into place that, you know, are both benefit, you know, it sounds like they're both helpful, but also kind of forced upon the system just to be able to survive for some period of time.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it's a super interesting experience, for consumers and, you know, in our industry of professionals alike. It's helpful to really pause and kind of appreciate the environment where, you know, in a pre-COVID world where in-person care is absolutely the norm, and all of our processes, all of our reimbursement, all of our tool sets that surround all the participants in the process are all built around this in-person dialogue that's happening between consumers and clinicians. And then you move to it, you move to an environment where that's just simply not an option. Yet care must continue. So you see this, this environmental change where we have telehealth or virtual care encounters literally go from, you know, very, very low volumes, and really kind of like allocated to a scope of care that's very like, you know, oh, I have a cold, my sinuses are bad. You know, it's like very, very narrow scope of care, very narrow set of reimbursement opportunities around this kind of like virtual or digital encounter. And you see that go from, you know, very low volumes to literally, you know, we're seeing data that says there were 96 million video visits during kind of the heart of COVID. And, you know, there's really no way that can happen smoothly. Yet we, you know, from my experience, what we observed is an incredible rise to the occasion as an industry, especially health systems who are kind of, you know, frontline delivering care and overnight, you know, cobbling together what they can to make sure they're meeting the needs of their consumers, of their patients. So pretty incredible environment.
So it kind of, as you said, there was that explosive growth, and now it's, you know, the newer data seems to suggest, you know, this ongoing slow ramp down where it's eventually going to, I think, hit, you know, a plateau or, you know, kind of hit the new level set of where, you know, where it'll initially be. So, you know, kind of how do you see that transition occur, you know, continuing to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we're seeing really good data roll up from lots of really great sources, but we're also seeing the way this is playing out with in partnership and collaboration with our clients, where we're really looking to collaborate together to kind of rethink and reshape and really take advantage of essentially a new care setting to really improve patient experience and improve the flexibility of care delivery. And so, you know, because it's like, you know, we have these incredible opportunities now. Because if you think about an in-person encounter, you think about like, okay, I got to get on the phone. That's interesting. I got to make a phone call oftentimes to make an appointment. I have a waiting period to get in front of a professional. So I might have to wait a couple of weeks to see a doctor or a clinician in person. I have to make sure that, you know, as the appointment approaches, I have to make sure that someone's at home taking care of things that need to be taken care of while I'm away. I have to drive, I have to park, I have to make my way through sometimes super complex campuses. I have to find the registration desk. I have to follow odd shaped, like directional arrows that are in various colors on the floor or on the wall. I have to go check in. Then I have to be in a room with a bunch of others who are feeling kind of under the weather themselves. And it's not an awesome environment. Then I have to go in, you know, like this whole experience of in-person care many times super, super necessary because of the resources that coalesce in that facility. The facility is important for a lot of reasons, but for a lot of care, it's not that necessary. So you know, what I like right now is what we're seeing is in the early days of COVID, it was a rush to get infrastructure, processes, and staff in place to offer the right services in a virtual way. And many times that meant kind of like cobbling together approaches that were never really meant to scale and live on forever. It was just meant to turn the switch on. And I kind of think of that as the scrappy phase, and where the most resourceful kind of benefited from this huge leap in utilization. And we were seeing clients who had well over 1,000% increase in telehealth visits. And then, you know, and now we look at it and we go, as an industry, we saw maybe 78 time increase between February of last year and April of last year in virtual visits, telehealth visits all by itself. And now fortunately we're kind of moving to this more strategic place. And this kind of circles back to the utilization that we're seeing and maybe what the right balance is, but we're seeing this super thoughtful capital and strategy being applied to kind of optimize that virtual care setting. And this is where, from my perspective, our collaboration with our clients in the market is most impactful and most fun, because we're thinking through how to make the processes and the experience for both clinician and patient and the consumer even better. And it's even better in some cases than in-person care, because think back to that long list of things we deal with for in-person care. And there's a benefit, but like, do we always have to go through that whole thing? And so, And the reality is now that we're through this, we're starting to see the usage of this telehealth or virtual care setting as an option stabilized around, you know, 38 times what was pre-COVID. And that translates into, I think the last stats I was seeing, was, you know, about 13 to 17% of care across all care settings happening virtually now. And the majority of clinicians and consumers, they want to see that continue as an option. Now, of course, from a clinician perspective, will we maintain the options for reimbursement that we currently benefit from right now in kind of this special time? I think, you know, we'll need to wait till the end of the year to kind of see how, you know, federal regulators and then kind of like private insurance kind of come together and kind of coalesce around what that looks like. But I think, you know, we know that 2/3 of physicians would love to see a continue if reimbursement's there, and a majority of health consumers would love to see that option continue. And it's stabilizing at, I think, it's a good level, you know, 13 to 17%, maybe 20% as a stabilization point. I mean, why not? That's a good digitization impact based on what was a pretty rough experience for all of us. So,
yeah, and I think you hit on a number of the key components there, which, you know, arguably the most important one being that, as you said, both the clinicians and the patients have found a lot of positive impacts from the use of virtual care options and want to see it continuing. I mean, and I feel like I see a lot of that anecdotally just through, you know, talking with folks or, you know, seeing messages that come up on social media, and everyone, you know, from both sides of that equation are wanting to continue, as you said. But, you know, the kind of tag along piece, which was the last one you're talking about, is it's not going to keep being used by the system side if there's no payment for it, which was arguably probably the biggest barrier pre-COVID, because all these technologies existed. You know, maybe they hadn't necessarily been proven out, but they were all there waiting to be used, but there was no financial incentive to use it, or there was arguably a financial penalty, because you, even though you knew that you could be more efficient and you could be meeting patients where they are, you'd be losing out on money, and you could potentially put yourself into a situation as a practice or a system where, you know, you could jeopardize the, you know, the ongoing existence of your organization.
Yeah. I mean, I think right on. I think, you know, well said. I do think that you know, just one point to kind of call out, I think, is that even though we know the technology, like the capabilities existed to create the type of virtual care experiences that we fundamentally probably all benefit from having available as an option to improve access, to improve, you know, the care experience, and the just the flexibility of care delivery is a benefit for healthcare consumers, who I think are kind of the biggest benefactor of what was a really tough period of time. But I think one of the things that we keep seeing surfacing again and again is it's one thing to kind of get the infrastructure in place to make the actual telehealth visit happen. But it's not as simple as like just picking up your iPhone and using FaceTime or using your Android device and using, you know, the video calling features there. It's not that simple. And, you know, we're on Zoom today. Like they're, you know, if at its base, it's not really designed to facilitate an expert dialogue with a consumer. It's not surround. Like if you put yourself into the setting of flying an airplane, and if you go back, you know, 20, 30 years, and you think about the instrumentation, and then you compare that to today in a fighter jet with like heads up displays and like, you know, constantly scanning the terrain, looking for problems and signaling if you should be paying attention over here versus over there. And I mean, I think, you know, in an expert industry like this, I think fortunately folks like Zoom, Microsoft, as kind of broad platform innovators are doing a lot to try and figure out what's the best way to support this kind of unique use case for a healthcare interaction. And I think, you know, specialty solutions, you know, we love folks like Doximity who are literally the switch that turns a clinician, you know, in the on mode for supporting virtual care delivery, and they're kind of focused on healthcare. It's all the right direction. And like you said, the capabilities existed, but now we're in this phase of, you know, we were scrappy, but now let's be thoughtful. And now let's start figuring out, you know, what's missing in a virtual care encounter that's present in an in-person setting that we actually liked. Like when you're in the exam room and there's like a model of a human body, or there is the ability for a clinician to turn a screen towards you and point towards something on your anatomy to help you understand something, like how do you, you need to reproduce that. Like you need a really cool virtual waiting room that lets you kind of dive deeper into why you're seeing your doctor today while you're waiting, and while you're interacting with that clinician. The clinician needs a heads up display. They need that decision support right now, you know, to help them navigate. Because that's what they're used to in a in-person care setting. They've got their electronic medical record, they've got their decision support tools, the full toolkit. So I think there's now an opportunity for a toolkit, an innovation, moment for us to really make these types of care delivery settings even more powerful than what we've experienced in person. So.
Yeah, no, and I think kind of as you're describing, you know, you kept using the word scrappy, and, you know, I think you're describing the maturation process of, yeah. You know, you got in there, you got used to using the tools, and now you start refining to make it as effective and efficient as possible. And I think that's a great way to, unfortunately, have to conclude our discussion, because believe it or not, we're already out of time.
No way.
I want to thank my guest, Jason Burham, for a great conversation today.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Really appreciate the time.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at #HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.